This is the Life Therapy with Zita podcast. I'm Zita. Hello and welcome to Conversations with Ourselves, the first episode of the Life Therapy with Zita podcast. In this series, we are but going to basically be doing just that, having conversations with ourselves. When I was young, my mother always used to tell me that the best person usually to get advice from was yourself. If you had a conversation with yourself, you would eventually find the solution in the problem. But if you couldn't, then go and have a conversation with someone wonderful who could inspire you to see a situation differently, have a view from a different perspective. And in this way, you were effectively still having a conversation with yourself, but and someone else. And so this is what bore fruit through to conversations with ourselves. I tend to think that we also meet each other like trees. Trees stand tall and we notice their branches and their leaves and their changes that they go through as they adapt to each season. But what we often don't really pay too much attention to is the roots of the trees. What was it that inspired that tree to grow in the way that it did? Same with the people. Who are they? Where are they from? What are the stories that they were born into? What shaped them and made them the way they are? And in some ways, perhaps even directed the course of their life. In whatever direction it takes, we are all in some way leaders in our lives. I was very fortunate to recently meet with Dr. Maggie Semple OBE and invite her to have a conversation with ourselves. She was kind enough to oblige. Maggie is a successful businesswoman and an entrepreneur. She is a member of the Queen's Council appointment panel. She serves on a range of boards, including the South Bank Arts Centre. In 2010, Maggie set up Semple, a bespoke women's fashion brand to empower like-minded women. Of course, I was so curious to know more about Maggie and her story and to learn a little bit more about not just who she is as a public figure, but who she is as a private figure. With her wealth of experience, her conversation was rich. We talked about ancestry, education, women, leadership skills, women and leadership, and female power, the legal profession, and bespoke fashion for business women and professional women. It was a rich conversation filled with insights and bubbling to the surface Maggie's perspective. Some of this I really related to it, and some of it was quite new to me. But either way, it was a great conversation to have, and I hope that you will enjoy listening to it too. So I give you Dr. Maggie Semple, OBE. So, Maggie, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And so looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Oh, I've been excited for days. I love talking to you and I love your energy. There's always such a vibrancy that you bring. And being in the presence of that is a very rewarding experience.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. So one of the things I'm quite curious to ask you is a little bit about your background. You know, it's one of these questions that I think is so valuable in terms of really understanding people, what shaped them. We don't just appear suddenly out of nowhere. We come from great stories, sometimes sagas and sometimes fairy tales.
Yeah.
So tell me yours.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask the question because on several levels, the first is there has been a time, and I particularly talk about the UK, but probably more globally, where if you were to start a conversation with somebody about where are you from, it has, or it still could be seen as quite a negative thing, almost suggesting, well, you're different from us or me or we, so where are you from? And I'm not sure with that questioning whether it sets up a good discussion for the person who's been asked the question to reply in a way that you're not sure. So sometimes, when I was growing up in London, people would go, where are you from? And I'd go, well, I was born in Hackney and, you know, I live in London. No, where are you from? So I think asking people where they're from, for me, second point here, in order for me to work with people, understand people, appreciate how I could learn from them, it is a very early question for me to ask.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, where are you from? It's about not only geographically where you are from, that's one thing, but also I just see where are you from as being a bigger question, which is more about, for me, your legacy, you know, who's influenced you, why are you as you are today that I can see, because I need to understand you. And the work that I do, particularly in the corporate sector, when people, we do our self-portraits, and I say to my colleague, Chris or Anthony or whoever, what would you say about me that we can tell the group? And they both will say, you know, to work with Maggie and to really understand how she works and how she thinks, she will ask you where you're from. So I guess it's a long way of answering your first question.
It's a beautiful answer.
Which is, I think it's a really significant and bold question to ask people. Where I'm from, therefore, eventually,
exactly,
is for some reason, and I still don't know why, I believe that I have what I describe as an old soul.
Mm.
And I think I've had this feeling ever since I was a small child. I didn't use it badly. I just thought that the things I was thinking, the way I behaved, suggested to me that my parents were very influential, my brother and sister were influential in shaping me, I guess. But there was something else that was shaping me, and I refined it to my soul. At that point, I didn't know where my soul was and who it was, and so, but I just felt it was old. And I still have that feeling today. So where I'm from, at one level, I don't know, because my soul is inhabiting me at this point in time, but it possibly, I would say stronger, it has inhabited others at previous times. So that's one thing. But then when I get to the more tangible and where am I from, well, I can say, yeah, I was born in London. That's where I'm from. And that's kind of an easy comment. And you look at me and you, depending on who's looking, actually, because they'll have a perception of who I am, you will agree with that or think, oh, that's curious and so on. But when I go back a generation to my parents and their parents, and then what people say, particularly when they draw me, because I've had a couple of sittings, not many, of people who draw me or paint me, and then they talk to me about what I exude, which is more than just my geographical or kind of biological heritage.
Mm.
But let me get onto the kind of biological heritage. So my name is Maggie Semple. Actually, it's Margaret Semple. And for me, a name is very important, very important. And however that name has come to you, whether you have been, whatever the religion, you've been given it, or you have chosen it yourself later on in your life to change what, for me, what I'm interested in is, what is your name? That might help me understand a bit about, more about who you are. It might not. But I know when I work with colleagues from around the world who have names that I cannot pronounce because they're difficult, I'm very honest with it. And I say, to be honest, if I see an X and a Z next to each other and a Y, I'm not sure how to say that. Can you help me say your name? And they go, Maggie, just call me, and they'll shorten it to a Western name. I go, no. For me, that's not your name. Thank you for helping me. Help me pronounce your name so I understand it. So first, for me, a name is very significant about who you are and where you are from. I believe that names are given because they're within a societal context, the environment you're in, but they're of a time and of a period. So Margaret Semple is a good Scottish name. That's the first thing. And where does that come from? Now, I didn't know any of this really until I was a little bit older, in my kind of early adulthood. So I knew it a bit about my parents, but I didn't know where my name had come from until I went to Scotland, Edinburgh, actually, and found there were streets called Semple.
Oh.
And there's a big street called Semple, a big road called Semple. I thought, oh. And then I looked into it a bit further and found out that actually it's a Highland. Semple's a clan. It has its own emblem. It has its own tartan. And it's called the Semple. So, okay, fine. That's interesting to know. My grandfather was a Scotsman, a white Scotsman. I'm a black woman, a white Scotsman, who travelled from Scotland. He was an engineer, and he travelled to a place called British Guyana in South America as an engineer, as did many, many peoples around the world travel, regardless of what we think about immigration. People have always travelled.
Always.
And good, because what about that host community, etc.? The food, the culture, the language, the ways of viewing, I think, if open enough, the open culture, the host culture, to become better, more sophisticated as a culture. My father, grandfather travelled, went to a place called British Guyana, at the time a British colony, the north part of South America on the Caribbean coast and so on. There are three Guyanas, French, Dutch and British. My parents are British. And my grandfather Semple arrived, worked on the railways that the British were putting in. And my father was born. Robert Semple. Good Scottish name.
Yes.
And he became an engineer. And as a result of my grandfather's presence and work, the Semple name, not just through him, but just got a bit more embedded into the culture, and opportunities were enabled for my father. So, for example, and I say this, and I hope you'll kind of not forgive me, but just understand why I'm saying this. Colonization of any nation to another is on the whole not good.
Totally agree.
But when I look at British Guyana particularly and think, what did the British leave or what did it instill? I'm not talking about how it did it. It left behind and instilled a very, well, when I say a very good education system, it's only because I was born in Britain and I became a teacher. So I would say there was something about the British way of educating and the content that was helpful. That my father was that generation that benefited from that, from colonization. And as a result, he went to university in the US. Guyana had its university that many people in the Caribbean traveled to. It was that kind of environment. So you might say, I would argue, maybe there's one good thing that came out of colonization. Maybe there were others, but it's not something I want to kind of particularly be proud of. But my father benefited from being colonized in a positive way. So then my father, born in British Guyana, my mother born in British Guyana, of what we would describe now from a UK point of perspective, an Indian descent, married, came to London, and my sister and I were born. So geographically, I was born in London.
Yes.
Biologically, I was born elsewhere and elsewhere. And if I delve further, I could have my feet in different parts of geographically the world, but also biologically. So that's on two levels. But the one I just want to just pause on at this point and just leave you with at this point is almost the unexplainable heritage and where am I from? Because sometimes I think, where am I truly from? And I don't feel nomadic. I don't feel unhappy at being where I am in London. And I love London and so I don't feel unhappy about that. But there's another part of me that says, yep, absolutely. But what you bring to yourself and to London today is a heritage of that which you still don't know what it is. And I'm still learning.
Yes.
And I think that keeps me humble. It keeps me, I try to be honest. And even though I've had opportunities, I've earned them, I've won them, I've lost some, you know, and so on. Deep down, who I am, which starts with my name, is who I am. And that whole thing about where am I from is not just a one level.
It's wonderful to hear this story about you. And one of the things I noticed sitting here with you is how empowered and strong that connection seems to make you present. And that's a really beautiful thing to witness in another human being. Thank you for sharing that. I'm glad that I know a little bit more about where you are from.
Yeah. And just with that, there are pictures of me as a child, 9, 10 years old. And I still have a few and I look at them. And everyone, if I showed it to you now, you go, absolutely, Maggie, that is you. You haven't changed one bit. You know, even if you're much older, you haven't changed one bit. And I think, what shines has shone through me, which some people, when they meet me, find a little formidable, they describe me as, or a little bit, they're wary, is because there is something deep down inside of me that says, no matter who you are, no matter how much joy or how much harm you wish upon me or bring upon me, you will not succeed. Mm. And that calmness, as a child, just enabled me to quietly do what I want to do, grow in the way that I think I want to grow, and be open to learning, but also know there's a little bit more to me than that which meets the eye.
It really touched my heart to hear you talk about this connection or belonging to soul. It's such a beautiful part of the self that so often gets left behind or forgotten, but it's such a deeply enriching and nourishing part of who we are.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So I'm curious, as a woman, I think I'm always quite nosy about other women and what moves them, what motivates them. And to me, that always comes back to Mama. Our first love, from whom we learn so much.
Yeah.
And sometimes in passing, I've heard you mention your mother, but I don't know much about her or your relationship with her. What would you say was her greatest gift to you as a woman?
Her greatest gift to me, and I'm really clear about this, was a stillness. Absolute calm stillness deep inside of you. And, you know, I have a sister, her name's Evelyn. She's lively. That's what Evelyn means. Margaret means pearl. But Evelyn's, you know, so there's something, again, back to the name, it's kind of connected. She's lively. She laughs a lot. Of course, and I do too. Our voices are very similar in tone, in timbre, the speech patterns. Sometimes we confuse each other. We're on the phone. Who's talking here? Is it you or me? so we're conscious of our voices. And I would describe my mother, I think she would too, my sister too, to verify this, would say that she didn't have a resonant deep voice that I think I have, but her quiet, still calmness that came through in her voice, in the way that she plaited our hair, the way that she put cream on our arms and did our hands and massaged us, was all to do with centering yourself. And that's what she taught me in different ways. She didn't point a finger and say, this is how you become calm. She just, you know, I've got quite a few frown lines. I had them when I was very young. And she would just, when I was sleeping, just, you know, gently just touch my forehead as I slept in the evenings. So I think we're a loving family, but also things like touch was important. So I have no problems as an adult now, never have done, of people, a masseur coming and saying, right, I'm doing your shoulders. I go, great. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely fine with me. Head massage, I love it. And why is that? Because when I was young, to comb and manage my big, wild, natural hair, it required massaging and plaiting and all sorts of things.
And calm.
Absolutely. And calm doesn't mean slow.
No, not at all. To me, calm, I see power, I see strength, I see real confidence. I was actually thinking the other day, what would happen if I put an advert out for calm, confident women?
Yeah.
How many would come forward?
Yeah, interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that other people, and this is what with my mother, as I became older and she became older, I would look at her and think, you are so good for everybody and everyone. Mum, you know, just step back from that person or... And so on. So it's how other people treat that calmness and what they think that might be. For some, it could be seen as a sign of weakness. And I'm wondering, corporate life, which I've worked in, whether you put an advert out for a calm woman, you know, to come for a confident woman, whether we're still ready to understand what that really means.
Not quite yet. But I hope and I think and I would like to believe that we are getting this.
Yes.
I think part of it is because we live in a world that really supports the extrovert and a lot of liveliness. and doesn't really see the intrinsic value of someone who can really hold a space. And to hold a space, you have to be able to really connect with stillness. Mm. And that takes real confidence to be present with that. That's, as I see it, real power.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, maybe because I've seen it in the women that I've known, it's a beautiful thing. So that was her gift to you, the calmness, the confidence, the assurance. It allows you to really have a lot of freedom as a child growing up, knowing that there's this power you can lean into that is not flailing in the wind.
And I think that's right. The power, for me, as I look at myself now, but as a child, knowing I had this power and how it translated itself to me where I was fearful of the power, two things come to mind. As a young child growing up in London, I couldn't believe there's another part of the world that hated me because of the colour of my skin. South Africa. I couldn't make sense of it. And my father and mother, but my father particularly, was quite outspoken and quite political in the sense of his girls growing up to be women of who they want to be. So I just thought, how can that be? And when I thought about it, South Africa, as the media presented it to me and so on, and as I grew and got older, I thought, I don't want to go to South Africa ever because my power is quiet and calm. Mm. And I don't want to trigger it to be anything other than that in this country. And I think if I go to that hostile environment, as I saw it, because of the colour of my skin, which makes no sense to me whatsoever. Well, I know why it is, but it made no sense to me whatsoever. I'm not sure how I would become. I don't know. I was just fearful of myself using this quiet power to cause change somewhere else by going to a country. So I didn't go to South Africa for decades. And even after apartheid and Mandela and so on came through, it took me still a while. I've now been to South Africa, but it took a while to get myself there. So that's, for me, quiet power or being still and calm. And knowing you have something, but trying to manage how you unleash it for good.
It's an interesting one. Similar with South Africa, I remember kind of all of a sudden realising the taste of Granny Smith apples didn't taste very nice.
Yes.
And I remember my aunt actually saying to me, you have to remember, nobody oppresses the weak.
Mm.
And that for me was a signal that I had something that was so powerful, other people somehow wanted to make it small.
Mm.
And it allowed me to survive mentally and emotionally through that time when South Africa was going on.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can still be a challenge when I, out of the blue, hear the accent, I'm thrown back in history and I'm like, okay. Find the peace, find the calm. That was in the past.
I think you're right, because I am, in my kind of professional life, and my second point is this, that as a result of that thought of stillness and calmness about a place that I'd not been to, but only represented me on films, on TV, through the media, more or less, then when I had my own business and I employed people, I had my finance director at one point, a woman from South Africa. She was white, tall, blonde, and I just thought, what am I doing here? Mm. So there was a bit of my psychology, which is about, because of that, you have to be a racist, and therefore I'm not employing. In fact, that wasn't the case. Her parents fled the country.
Yeah.
And so it was all part of my opening up my eyes and awakening to the power that if I'd used it incorrectly too soon, it would have been not very good for me, let alone anyone else.
Yeah.
And my second point about professional life is about how to use this power is that it comes to, for me, I have this quietness. People read it in any way they wish to read it, I hope positively. But when I do see what I call injustice, that could be in a corporate environment where I think someone is behaving in a way that is, for me, unacceptable, I'll call it out. Now, I never raise my voice. I never do. I don't need to. In fact, you need to be worried when I lower it and it gets quieter. And I speak more slowly and more deliberately, because then you need to draw closer to me and I'm going to tell you quite quietly why what you've said or done is unacceptable. So I call things out. And for the person I've called, that they're behaviour out to, sometimes publicly, as in I'll direct a comment. What I'm saying more is, this is whatever that person said, let me just make a bigger point here. That kind of comment or that kind of behaviour is unacceptable. And I don't have to be the boss in this situation or the director or the senior person. I could be a little cog in this huge wheel, but I still won't be unafraid of calling out behaviours, language, opportunities not given to people, given to people. I will say things. And as a result, and then I can step back and be quiet and calm, knowing that I've satisfied myself from that point of view. But for the person or the organisation or whatever, my unit that's heard it, then we go into a different dynamic. And how do people respond? They want to punish you, possibly. Or they, you know, they get hurt themselves. Not that it was like my intention. But you need to take, one needs to take responsibility for one's actions. We're adults in a corporate environment here, and so on. So that's my second point.
Which is a real leadership skill.
Yeah.
I mean, it's premium is to... It's not about being nice. It's about being honest and having integrity and standing by what you believe in. I think quite often we are taught as women that we have to be nice, and that that nice means not speaking up. I think nice or kind means speaking up and being brave, courageous.
Absolutely. And you know, when you do it as a woman and other women observe, I've also had this scenario where I've, you know, I've heard something and I've just sat, heard it, and it's eating me inside, and I'm thinking, it's in a meeting. No, I can't let that go. This meeting will just go on a track that is not right. No, I can't let it go. And I've spoken up. And that's been that. And the meeting's ended. And then I get called aside and someone says, Maggie, you know, you shouldn't really have said that. And I go, well, look, I did. And that's what I'm having. And then I get called aside by a few more people that go, Maggie, so glad you said that. And I go, so where were you in the meeting? Why didn't you support? It was a sole voice. And for me, when I think about it, I think, okay, maybe sometimes, even though I find this hard to do, maybe sometimes I should not quite always speak up straight away. I mean, I'm very polite. No one could argue that, because I've had feedback on this. But maybe what I should do is elicit other supporters around me, some other allies to the point I'm trying to make. So when I do make it, I can count on the person 2 seats away to also contribute to that comment.
Interesting. An interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. Because time's not on our side, it doesn't always work like that. But
it doesn't always work like that. And I think sometimes the value of who we are is being completely authentic, even if that is not perceived as being the right way to be. What is ever really the right way to be, other than truly who you are? And if we can sort of sometimes let go of this judgment, oh, you've got to be like this and you've got to do it like that and blah, 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 we might have so much more.
Yes.
If we didn't keep trying to put lids on boxes about how things should be. That's my feeling, but I'm kind of wildcat myself. I'm a bit outspoken, but I passionately believe in justice. And if I see an injustice being that, that's my I don't have to get loud about it, but I will call it out similarly quietly. Excuse me.
The other day, just on, I was walking through where we're in Covent Garden, and a car pulled up and the window was down, music was blaring, and the driver was very exasperated by the car in front. I could tell from the angles they both stopped at the traffic lights because they were not going anywhere separate. They were going to crash into each other, So they stopped, and the car, this window went down, music in. The driver was swearing away, get moving, come on. All this. Anyway, I just observed it, and I just thought, I feel like going over to that driver. So I went over to the driver, and I just said, hey, are you in a bad mood? He goes, why'd you say that? I said, well, you're swearing a lot about the car in front. And he said, in a tone of music, I said, say it again. I said, well, you know, you kind of got an energy that I just sense is not going to help you get anywhere faster. And he laughed and he smiled. He said, you know what? You've made me smile. thank you. I said, yeah, I mean, this could have gone two ways. I said to him, you could have just told me to get lost as well. But I just got a sense from you that actually, you know, speaking up sometimes is a bit of a risk, but may not always end up badly.
Yeah, more often than not, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Because even those who were in support quietly, something changed for them.
Yeah.
And we don't know what happens when they go off to the next scenario. They might find the courage to go, okay, I've seen this other lovely lady do it. Now I'm going to be inspired by that.
It's true.
The knock-on effects, the ripple effect, we never see.
No, you're right.
For me, it's about trusting that because an intention is good, it will continue to be good.
Yes.
And that's the unseen, the power of the unknown and the unknowable.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
So, yeah, I'm sure that driver's still chuckling away now every time he's about to get
crazy. Woman kind of came up to me.
He's probably a little bit hot, babe.
I'll let you know.
Please do. So, so lovely to hear these stories. I'm really enjoying this. So another thing I'm really curious about, again, you know, a lot of my nosiness, I guess, about other people, my interest in other people is, of course, motivated by my own self. We are all sort of self-driven in some way, shape or another. And I learn from understanding through other people's stories. So your career story, you'd mentioned earlier on something about becoming a teacher. Is that where you started? Is that your basis background? Was that your, and when I grow up, I'm going to be a teacher?
No, not quite. And I guess when I look at myself and look back, there's nothing linear about me. A, in the way I think, that's one thing, and also the way that I have behaved to opportunities that have been put in front of me.
Right.
So I can't say I did this and this and this and this. I've tended to do a few things at the same time. Now, I have a sister who is different from me in all sorts of ways, but you might argue, no, hasn't done that. She's done things in a more linear way, but I just haven't done that. Never, as a child, again, I did many things, not in a linear way. So where did I start? I would say, well, when I was young, I used to be a Sunday school teacher. And it was because, now why was that? I know why that was, actually, if I'm honest. My sister could sing really, really well. She still does. And I can sing okay, but she hasn't had a voice. And we found out that the local church needed people to join the choir. Well, I found out, actually. And I must have been 10 or 11. Yeah, 12, something like this. So it would enable me to find out that the church, local church, wanted to have some new choir members. And what I did find out also, that when you sang in the choir on a Saturday for weddings, you got paid.
Uh-huh.
So, it sounds like a film now. I took my sister to the audition, not quite.
That's how films get made.
Exactly. So my sister and I, probably my parents took us somewhere, you know, and she sang and I kind of sang with her.
I love it. Such a good time.
Yeah. And because, to be honest, we were the only two little black girls for miles around in Middle of London at that time. Not that we didn't get it because of that, but A, I think we looked good, but also my sister sang very, very well. Now, what was my contribution? So my contribution was, A, that we got paid for this, 5 shillings in the old days for every Saturday that we sang. And I opened up my first savings account with the post office.
The Blue Book.
Yeah. You know it. I know, I know. And that for me began an ethos of actually being rewarded for services that you give. So that was that. My contribution as I got older, it's like we stayed in the church and it did all sorts of things, part of socialisation of the young people. And I wouldn't say that I was particularly religious, but it was just another place to learn. I became a Sunday school teacher. So about 12, 13, I guess. And I had my little class. I think, what was it, before, after church? I can't remember what it was, But it was just only half an hour. And I used to enjoy telling stories from the Bible, making them kind of real, and then the class would draw them all. It was just, so for me, it was quite natural. And then when you couple that with, we lived, but in Crouch End in London, and we had a huge house and a big garden, and there were lots of big gardens. I think it was 14 houses all in a row, and each house had some children in it. And I set up, because we had a garden shed, this little kind of, I call it a gang in a positive sense, and children from the other houses could jump over our walls and all join the gang. My sister used to say to me things like, "You do know you ran that gang like a school." People would have to jump over the walls and then kind of register with you.
Early leadership skills.
Exactly, all of that. So it wasn't a surprise for me, but I had in my head, naturally, that I'm not only a learner, but I like to teach as well, whatever that thinking was. So yes, and my sister could sing, but actually I could dance, as my sister could as well. So I, early on in my life, in fact, particularly at university, but as I was growing up, we danced as well as sang. And those were recreational activities, and all part of being a whole person, really. Mm. Your creativity, learning how to receive instructions from other people to do things, learning, we call it a physical memory, but an agility of the mind to remember things. And my father used to play games with us on trays, put things out on trays, and give us 5 minutes to look at it, then go out the room, he'd take things away, come back in again. The game was, what's missing? You know, those sorts of games are all about intellectual discovery and so on. So I was curious from an early age. Well, that was my environment that I grew up in, to be curious about knowledge, really. And I'm still curious. So I did some dance and danced for a while.
What kind of dance?
Contemporary dance.
Oh, fantastic.
My last gig was 1989 on the stage of the Royal Festival Hall.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I shouldn't have been dancing. I was a little bit old, I have to tell you, but older than my other dancers. It's a young person's sport.
Well, I know fabulous women in their 50s dancing, myself included. Maybe not in public.
No, exactly. So I danced. That was very important for me. And that's been a thread throughout my life. The arts, cultural expression. I, you know, see dance a lot. I see the arts quite a lot. I'm on the board of the South Bank Arts Centre at the moment, but I've been on a number of boards, which is about cultural activity, because for me, globally, this is, how do you look at a society and value its worth? One of the things that I look at is, how does it treat its people? And what culturally is available to these people? And we know from history, throughout history, when people get uprooted and get expelled from their land, or they move to a new place, they bring certain things with them. And what they bring is, I say culturally, their language, their food, their clothing. So, you know, they bring all sorts of things, and either that gets modified, one hopes, to the environment in which they come. So if I began anything, it was this realisation of having this agility of thought, the agility of knowing that culturally, in my case, it was dancing. My sister's case, it was singing, along with the academic kind of pursuit. That's important for me now, looking back and seeing what I've done. I taught as well in a number of schools. I taught English. I taught dance mainly. And that was formative for me. I became an ILEA inspector for only a year, because then I got, in those days, it wasn't called headhunted, but the inspector of the division would say, and did say to me at one point, I was very young at this point, just left university, "Maggie, you're a star." And I thought, really? I'm sure everyone's a star. But actually, no, not everyone is. And I realised that I was being called a star, but I became a star because I believed I was a star.
Mm.
And again, it was a star that was quiet. It wasn't, you know, I mean, sometimes people look at me and think, "Gosh, Maggie, you stand on stage, you can do this, you can do that." I go, but deep down, I'm a quiet, considerate person. I might look extrovert. Actually, it's called ambivert. You know, I'm neither extra or intra. I'm ambi. I can do both, you know?
Yeah.
As and when I need to, that's part of my tools, my to find out who I am and how I represent myself. So through education, and why was I in education? Because it's back to, you know, I can learn a lot from these young people, learn a lot from my colleagues and these young people's parents, but also I have some content that I can deliver. And that's when I became the star, because there were films made about me teaching. It was things like, I have a philosophy that actually, no matter who you are, actually, if you're a child and you behave badly, well, okay, you have to understand there's a consequence for that behaviour. And not everyone has a straightforward, uncomplicated life. Actually, probably no one has, but as a child,
yeah.
you've got a lot to possibly deal with.
Yes.
So I'm not going to punish you doubly because you behave badly. What you need to know is calmly and quietly that that behaviour is unacceptable. And there are ways of dealing with it. So, and I see people now, they've got their own children. They go, I remember you at school. And I go, yes, call me Maggie. I'd never call you Maggie. You'll always be Miss Semple. And, you know, these are big people now. And they write to me, we link in on social media. I mean, they just tell me. The one thing that comes out from that part of my life was that I was always seen as being fair. So it doesn't matter who you were. You could be the naughtiest child in the school or when I took assemblies, you know, whoever you were. It was, we're going to be fair. That's how I was. And I tried to, through my actions, show and teach, particularly the pupils that came across, that I came across, that being fair is a way that, you know, the world would be a better place if ever it could be fair.
Totally agree. And I think children really value that growing up, that clarity. They know where they stand and that's all they want.
Yeah,
simplicity absolutely. And clarity. Okay, this happens now, this happens now. If I do this, that's not so great. If I do this, this is great. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, we all make mistakes.
Of course.
So that's true also. And, you know, I say to people, that was not a very good judgment, was it? That was a bit of a mistake. Hey, but listen, I make mistakes too. So we're all learning from each other. It doesn't stop when you're 15 or leave school at 18, whatever you do. Nope. Or when you leave home, nope. You carry on making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, it's the thought and the idea. You don't keep repeating that mistake. But this repetitive behaviour is one that any of us could get into because of circumstances around us. And
we all have patterns.
Yeah.
And patterns aren't so easy to break. But if you've got someone good out externally who can guide you and support you.
Absolutely.
And trigger this shift in thinking.
Yeah.
Which fairness invites.
Yeah.
Amazing things can happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And from my teaching and learning, I was this star that government of the day, several governments of the day, noticed. And so throughout, when was it? Early 90s, that decade, I worked a lot, not in government, I wasn't a civil service servant, but outside, advising on education policy. Because I came out of my school, I went somewhere else in an organisation that was about education, and the government said, can you join these various task groups, National Curriculum Task Group? Can you join the further education? Can you join the higher education, the adult education, lifelong education, and also e-learning? Just join these groups, and I say just, it's more than just, but bring your expertise next. And experience of being a teacher, just recently left, and you may well go back to it, which I didn't do, into our thinking about policy.
Mm.
Because for me, it was now me thinking, so I've been in these two schools actually for a while. There's more to this, that not the problem, but the challenge is each school has to deal with its dynamics, but I want to be able to help all schools or all education establishments. That was my thought, and I put it out there. This is where I learned even more to put things out there, and you never know when they land. And I got a phone call one day. It was from Department of Education, one of the civil servants. I actually thought it was a prank, and I went, yeah. They said, Maggie Semple. I was known Maggie by then. Maggie Semple, the minister is putting together a group of people that, to advise on the national curriculum. We wondered if we could talk to you about being on that group. And I went, yeah, absolutely. Nice prank. Put the phone down. My friend then who was in the service, went, Maggie, no, Maggie, it's a real call. Okay. So
did you call back?
I didn't call back. No, I said, just sorry to call you. No numbers. And I think they're used to that kind of risk calls. But that then put me into this bigger arena, and it took me internationally because it then took me into, so in this country, all these children have to be in statutory education, millions. What is the offer? Why is it that depending on your postcode, you either have a great life chance or you don't? Depending on how much your parents can pay for you, you either have a greater access to opportunity or you don't.
Mm.
If we wish to be fair, as much as we can, we need to do something about the statutory state education system. So that was the driving force for me. That was ministers wanted to, and I started working in that way with task groups. That was the 90s. And then end 97, 98, I joined Millennium Dome again in education, role director of education, where we designed, I had a big teams of people and delivered these programs with corporates with their funding on the nation's young people, statutory education. So for me, learning's been throughout. Mm-hmm. That's a key thing. Along the way, I always knew, back to my days when I got the role and job in the choir, that actually being entrepreneurial was also what I was quite keen on. And while I taught, I did other things. I lectured, you know, went Saturday morning, drove somewhere, gave a speech on a stage. I did quite a few things with other schools. I gave out prizes, you know, all those sorts of things I think any citizen should do if they can.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great believer in you can either call it paying forward or giving back, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, if you can, and I think most people can, and the opportunities are there. It doesn't have to be forever, and it could be just half an hour once a month. But if all of us did that, how amazing would the resource of all people, not just
all
young,
people. Absolutely,
would be fantastic. So I kind of carried on my entrepreneurial doings and getting again a name for myself for just being able to lecture on things. Again, I was traveling internationally, guest speaker at conferences. Bringing together, and this is the point I want to make here is not only my learning, understanding, experience, pedagogy, but also a slightly more entrepreneurial take on that. What does it offer us? And it started to speak to what I'm now doing. And when I look back now, there's someone called Howard Gardner, who's a professor at Harvard, who wrote in the 80s, I think, late 80s, a book called Multiple Intelligences. And I actually kind of read it, the book, knew about it in the 90s, let's say. But what it said to me, and the theory behind it, some of his work, I paraphrase now, that each individual has multiple intelligences, not just one. In education, we are, at least my language, we're absolutely fixated on IQ. We test for IQ. Now, when I work now, fast forward to my corporate work, there are adults, there are leaders and so on globally. We take for granted that they have some intelligence. Intelligent quotient, we take that for granted because of their qualifications, what they've done and so on. What we now need to think about, and that's what I discuss, is their emotional EQ. You know, their spatial intelligence. And this is what Howard Gardner talks about, the different intelligences that every individual has. Some are stronger for some people than other people, but we all have it maybe, or perhaps we should teach them or create opportunities in our curriculum for these different intelligences to be understood and nurtured by people, learners.
I totally agree. And it's almost full circle back to the beginning that's actually about learning stillness.
Yeah.
From a very early age.
Today, I guess, so you did ask me originally a question, kind of my career trajectory, and I've just said it doesn't have, there isn't one, but there are themes.
Yes.
And that's my career trajectory, as opposed to I worked in a bank here and I did this and so that. For me, again, it's a bit like where are you from question. These are bigger questions than just how they appear. For me, at the moment, I'm looking at what Gardner now has updated his intelligence discussion to what he calls laser intelligence and search intelligence. And I see myself as having this next intelligence, which is search intelligence. Now, what that means is this. I've demonstrated it all my life, but now so even more, that for someone, I think for me, so I'm making sense of what he says, search intelligence is that I'm very good at searching, like a bit like a search engine, really. I search. I hear you speak, Cedar. I hear this, I hear that. I grab here, I think that, and it all gets churned in my brain. And then I give a holistic response to what that is. And that he describes as search intelligence, the ability to transfer knowledge, understanding in one area to another sphere. And just as in with digital, you know, you can go alt, delete and shift and command and so on. That's got into our daily language, you know. So I just go, I'm doing a right-hand swipe here for you. You know, I mean, you just use it differently.
Of course.
Which it was never intended to, we didn't know. Just like medicine when it was first kind of any scientific, any thought actually, any piece of language that was originally described in this way, actually it's been applied creatively by people because that's what human beings do in another context.
Yeah.
So for me, where I'm today in my kind of career trajectory is, and I've had various psychometric tests. I have them done every 2 years just to keep me alert to any new learning for me, any more clarity or focus to who I am, because it helps me describe myself to others. And my learner, the learner in me and the teacher in me is still very, very, very strong. It will never go. So I can't fight that. That's who I am. But this kind of search intelligence has just given that learner aspect of me a bit of refresh. For me to go, yeah, now I can start thinking about that this way and apply that with even more confidence in the way that I'm taking one bit of knowledge or thought or what I've searched out. And it's a bit like a searchlight, actually, is what he calls it, a searchlight. It starts from a single point, but it spreads out like a torch. But I gather that and apply it in a different sphere.
Oh, it's like a squirrel that goes out and gathers all the nuts and stuff that it needs for winter and gets them all in one place and can know, okay, I've got all of this.
Yeah.
It's here, this storehouse of information.
Yeah. As opposed to what he calls laser, which is laser specific.
Right.
I'm more, in fact, he calls it searchlight. More searchlight. That squirrel gathers all that stuff from this light.
Yeah.
And then helps you make sense of it.
As opposed to, for example, the owl that's on its branch and goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Spin the head round and it's in this.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. I love it. It's so lovely to hear, literally, to hear people's stories. You learn so much, not just about them, but understand what motivates them and moves them. I mean, now,
where are you?
Where has this all
channeled this? Yeah, absolutely. I would say in three ways I've channeled this energy.
Yeah.
This history. This kind of alchemy of who I am.
Mm.
I've channeled it down three ways. And this is my professional life. So the first is, no particular order, the first is this, that I currently work in the legal justice system in the UK. And what I mean by that is that I'm part of a group called the Queen's Counsel Selection Panel. So we appoint barristers and solicitors at the top end of their game to become Queen's Counsel, QCs. That, for me, it's my second year of doing it. It's a 5-year appointment, is not only rewarding, but I really feel that I'm making a contribution to justice in the UK. Because if we can appoint people in a fair and meritocratic way, which in the past, 20 years ago, was not the way that you became a QC, now you have to apply. You have to demonstrate competencies, including not only your legal understanding and applying it to the law, but your understanding of diversity and your understanding of working with others. Because the bar, the legal justice system, our court service has to demonstrate that it is keeping up with society and its mores of the time. Given that these people are our guardians for legislation in terms of implementing the law. So I do that. That's one thing. That brings my justice and fairness discussion. Another is that I run a business that was at one point quite big and gave me lots of headaches, but now it's smaller and I contract people into my work teams as and when a client wishes to have particular skills. I'm very clear now what I can and can't do. I'm very clear what I will and will not do. But this business is works with corporate organisations, global ones, that have footprints all over the world. And I'm very interested in their leadership. That leadership, how, you know, so back to our intelligences, what do our leaders need in this business so that we retain or get better as a business, global business? It's competitive out there, but we are still here in 20 years' time, 50 years' time, 100 years' time. So I do that. And that speaks to, again, this thing about society and the place of big business in society and what's it there to do. And it's there to, of course, make a profit. I have no problem with that, because that means that wherever its hub is, I would imagine the government's there, you know, it goes into the tax system. I mean, I get all that. It pays for our pension system. I mean, I get all that. But it also, and most good businesses have this actually, they realise that the economical kind of the economics, the monetary driven profit making focus to business cannot be the only focus that today's modern business has to have. You know, apart from compliance and governance and so on, it needs to show what I call it, that it has a heart. And people trust your brand. They want to, because at the end of the day, they want to be associated with you.
Yes.
And they will defend you, or they'll speak up for you if they trust you.
Yeah.
So I do quite a lot of work on trust without leaders, with leaders around the globe. And I'm told, because I'm not from the sector, could be a technology sector necessarily, because I'm not. But what I think I'm now beginning to hear from people is why they like me to do the work that I'm doing with them is, A, because I can deliver the messages in a very, not only cogent, but intellectually rigorous way. And I say it in the way that I say it, my deep voice, which commands this power. So that there's that that makes it work. But also they're benefiting from, I realise now, from my searchlight intelligence.
Yeah.
I bring different aspects of what I know, what I've snatched from the radio, from my social media activity, that, and so I bring that together and position a thought or a view, and then we can discuss it. That's the second thing. The third thing I do is I have always been very motivated about women, because I am one, but also that there is so much more that we have to contribute to wherever we are. And for me, giving women voices, what can I do to help that? Because when you give a woman a voice, there can be very few, if any, downsides to that, depending on whose perspective you look at, of course. But
no,
today's modern world.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah.
It's vitally important. And it's, as I see it or witness it, it's not just giving them a voice, but supporting women to take their voice.
Absolutely.
And come out from the shadows and come out from hiding and come away from feeling invisible and recognize they have every right and every value to be seen and heard. It's a two-way thing.
Yeah.
They can ask to receive that light. I also really want to support and encourage them to give their light.
That's lovely. Absolutely.
Infinite loop of love. That's what it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Love makes the world go round. Literally.
Yeah.
Agreed. I mean, whether it's in business or our day-to-day interactions or the exchange of goods and services, it's always back to love. Even money is just love as an energy form transmitted into paper.
Totally agree.
And if you kind of got a problem with money, you're going to have a problem with love. If you've got a problem with accepting and loving yourself, it's going to be very difficult to say, here I am.
Mm.
I have so much to give you.
Mm.
And yeah, I appreciate you bringing that to light.
Yeah. So my third business then, how do I make that real for women to have this voice, to know they have it, and as you say, support them through that? We make clothes. And for me, it's quite a simple proposition. This is where I play on my name, Maggie Semple. You know, it's simple, really. But what's the proposition? Well, it is that we wish to make women happy. How do we do that? Simply, we make their clothes. They are bespoke, they're made for that person's personality. We choose our colours with the client, we design the garment, dress, trousers, jacket with the client. And we know, because we've been doing it a few years now, we know, as I've always known, because I've always had my own clothes made for me by an Italian designer, that when you wear something that has your signature in it, your personality, your love embedded in your garment. And we've captured that. That's part of our relationship. We talk about the simple experience as opposed to transactional. Actually, I'm not so keen on transactional stuff. I much prefer a relationship. It means that when you leave here, in fact, I always say to people, you're not leaving here unless you love your garment. What do I have to do to make you love it? It starts with, you've got to feel good in it.
Yeah.
And the amount of joy I know that our garments bring, for me, is about empowering a woman. These women, she might be getting married. We've just done, I try not to do bridal things, but we've done a few, just to see this bride who tends to be a mature bride, wants a very classic, simple dress, but just the way it's been made for her makes her joyous. When I see an executive woman who's too busy to shop and look after herself, and I go, okay, I'm not going to comment on that, but let's get you while you're here into a wardrobe that means that when you travel all over the world, and you pack simple dresses, jackets, trousers, you can hang them up because they're made for your shape at a very good fabric, then that's half your battle gone for that morning. You get up, get into the boardroom, get on with the business.
Yeah.
You know, actually, when I began the brand, I had two designs. And what I wanted to do was just be known as the brand that people trusted.
It's interesting with women and work clothes, because it's finding that wonderful balance between being professional, but not having to go so deep into the masculine, basically wearing a male version on a woman, which is always, I think, an awkward, who are you?
Yes.
But embracing one's femininity in a way that says, I'm proud and respectful of my body. It is beautiful and it's got great strength, but I don't need to put it all out on that tape.
No, absolutely. And the first question we ask new clients is, tell me, do you like shopping? Everyone goes, no. Oh, why not? Because why do I have to wear orange this autumn when that's what all the shops have? And I can't wear orange. Why? And why is everything so strappy? So my message is, good, okay, fine. You're join the club. Join the club. And actually, the high street can't ever cater for every woman because we're all different sizes. So we cater for everyone. A size is not the important thing for us. It's whatever it is. We'll accommodate it and make you feel fantastic in what you've got. So women say to you, Maggie, I really must come to you, but I just want to lose a bit of weight. I go, fine, whenever you're ready. But secretly, I want to say to them, why don't you come in now?
Yeah.
Let's get on with making you something.
Yeah.
Wear it in the state that you're not so comfortable in your body, but let's wear it so you look fantastic. And listen, when you lose that weight, we're going to take it right in.
Absolutely. And when you have something that fits you, it's much easier to really embrace and love your body exactly as it is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about Simple Wear. And where can we find out more information about it if we're looking?
We have a website, which is www.maggiesample.com.
Fantastic. So log on to the website, book an appointment.
Yes.
Come in, leave feeling fabulous.
Yeah. And if someone is not in London, we communicate anyway, still book in or communicate with us. Our email addresses are there. And we will either Skype you. We've got clients in Australia, Canada, the US.
Uh-huh.
So, in fact, we've had an offer over the summer. A US, she's now a client, contacted me and said, Maggie, I'd love that dress. And I said, okay, so what are we going to do about measurements? She said, send me the measurement chart. I'll get my tailor to measure. So women are being creative with our offer. So, and then I can either ship out to her or we can get swatches of colours and I just describe the fabric. But it seems to be working too. So anyone who's listening and is not based in London.
Wherever you are.
Yeah, we can work with you.
Dial in, sign up. I love it. I think that's so wonderful. It's the beauty as well of modern living, that these things have been simplified in the way that you can do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gorgeous.
Great.
Thank you very much, Maggie, for spending time with us today. It's been absolutely wonderful to have you and to hear your wisdom and to see your smile and, you know, just it's so rich to hear these stories from women where you are in this position of what I call respectfully the elders, who can hand down this information to younger women to follow. That's the power of what women do, is teach each other, guide and support and mentor. I can imagine that when women come for their dresses, they get quite a lot of other stuff as well that really supports them in how they feel about themselves.
Yeah.
Especially in when they're roles of leadership.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I've loved having this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on the Life Therapy with Zita podcast. I hope you enjoyed conversations with ourselves. Please leave a review or send me an email via feedback. I'd love to hear your questions and your thoughts and even some input. What are the conversations you're having with yourself and with others who are around you? Bye-bye. Semple. The Semple collection specializes in luxury bespoke clothes for women. All garments are designed and made in the beautiful atelier in the heart of London's Covent Garden. For more information, please visit the website www.maggiesemple.com.